This lecture, entitled The Jewish Community, Jewry's Government in Exile, is dedicated to the merit and honor of the Newman family. As we've pointed out in previous lectures, during the pre-modern period, prior to emancipation, the Jews were viewed by their host nations as foreigners, aliens who were tolerated as long as they might able to be of some possible economic benefit to them. As a result, when circumstances changed, their hosts often had no compunction to expel them. On the whole, until the end of this period, since the Jews were viewed as foreigners, the governmental authorities generally did not interfere with the internal affairs of the Jewish community. They were interested, though, that the leadership of the community, the kehillah, take responsibility to maintain law and order within its borders and make sure that the special tax that the Jews had to pay for the right of residency was collected. The kehillah itself, during this period, was actually a theocracy. The Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law and its commentaries, which were ultimately based upon the Talmud, what was its constitution? A Jew who did not want to abide by this system of Torah law, as we will soon see, was considered to be a criminal and was often severely punished and cut off from interacting socially with the kehillah, the community. The kehillah also had the power to rescind the rebel's cheskas toshav, right of residency, declaring him in effect to be stateless. Other than submitting to rabbinic authority, the only other choice for such a person would be to convert to Christianity, a difficult choice for most Jews. Thus, the Jewish community in the era before emancipation was almost uniformly observant. It is no coincidence that at the end of this era, when the kehillah was no longer allowed by the secular government to punish, and to put a wrongdoer into cherem, a ban, that the whole Torah-based society began to unravel. This will be covered, Emir Hashem, in coming lectures. In this lecture, I would like to cover many of the halachic Torah-based principles that governed the Jewish community during this era. To give you an idea of how the community was run as an independent government, in many ways different from Jewish life today. For those that are sincerely observant, though, almost all of what we're going to cover is still relevant. We begin on page 1. This is section 1, Dina de Malchut Zedina, and the principle of Jewish self-governance. Although the Torah provides for a self-sustaining legal system, the Gemara also recognizes the power that a king or a non-Jewish government has to make laws. This power of legislation is referred to by the phrase, Dina de Malchusa Dina. The law of the kingdom or government is law. So while the kehillos were largely governed by the legal system of the Torah, the Shulchan Aruch, they were also bound to some extent by the laws of the government. The parameters of this principle, Dina Malchusa Dina, is the subject of much controversy. In paragraph A, we quote from the Shach, or Shapsig Cohen, one of the greatest Torah authorities of the 17th century, in his Pirish, in his commentary to the Shulchan Aruch. This is taken from Choshen Mishpat, Siman Ayin Gimel, chapter 73, and we read. This is also the opinion of the Shilte Geborim, in Perek Cheskas Habakim, at the end of page 189, who states, quote, "It seems to me that the principle Dina Malchusa Dina is only applicable to those laws that the king promulgates for his own benefit, such as tolls and tariffs, etc. Laws, however, that govern interpersonal relations that are only to be adjudicated according to our Torah, as it has been clarified in Kuntres Arayas, in the ruling of the first chapter of Gittin, and in Perek Get Poshet," end quote. This is the Shach quoting from the Shilte Geborim. Shilte Geborim is a commentary, which is really a commentary to the work of Rabbi Yitzchak Alfasi, the Rif, which is a condensation of the laws of the Talmud.
So this is taken from Perek Cheskabatim, the third chapter of Bava Basra. And the Shach continues, even those authorities who disagree with his ruling and maintain that Dina Malchusa Dina applies everywhere are also of the opinion that this principle is only applicable where the governmental decree is not running contrary to the Torah and only touches areas that are not explicitly covered by the Torah. But God forbid that one should follow the rulings of the Gentiles where it runs contrary to the Torah. This view of the Shach seems to have been widely accepted. In addition, the judiciary of the Kehillah was the sole place where a Jew was allowed to settle his grievances. He was not allowed at all to settle his grievances in a Gentile court. As we read from the Shulchan Aruch Chosha Mishpat, Simen Chavvot, chapter 26. It is forbidden to present one's legal issues before Gentile judges in their courtrooms, even if they are adjudicating the case according to Torah law, and even if both parties are willing to be judged by them. Anyone who comes before them to be judged is an evildoer. It is as if he mocked, blasphemed, and lifted up his hands against the Torah of Moses. And we read the gloss, this is from Moshe Israelish, and this is the main text of the Shulchan Aruch, this is from Yosef Karo. And the gloss, the Beis Din has the power to be menada, and put a ban, and put the wrongdoer in cherem, which is an extreme ban, until he removes the power of the Gentile court away from his fellow Jew. This is a quote from a tshuva responsum from Yosef Kolon, the Marik, number 154. Similarly, there would be machrim, a place of ban against anyone who went to Gentile courts. And this is the Rivosh, this is from Yitzhak Ben Sheshes, who was a leading authority in Spain at the end of the 14th century. Since the legal system of the Beis Din and the non-Jewish courts are often mutually exclusive, in the case where a Jew testified against another Jew in a Gentile court, and as a result of the testimony, the court ruled that the plaintiff must pay the defendant, if such testimony in a Beis Din, a Jewish court, wouldn't have yielded the same result, we read on page 2 in paragraph C, one who testified against another Jew in a Gentile court and thereby unjustly forced him to pay, is to be placed in nidui, placed under a ban, until he reimburses that person. This law is based upon the principle that only Torah law is recognized to be the governing legal system for a Jew. As I stated before, this was the system that governed all of Jewry in the pre-modern era. By the way, it is still the governing system for millions of observant Jews to this day. Now, there are situations, however, that Gentile law is honored. As we read from one of the leading authorities of the 17th century, Rav David Segal, in his commentary to Shulchan Aruch called Turei Zover Taz, for short. This thing from Yoredeya, this is chapter Simon, this is 157, Kufnun Zion. And it's paragraph 8, Sifches. Even in our own times, we hand over to the authorities a traitor who rebels against his government. Similarly, if one is involved in such crimes as counterfeiting or the like, which may well put the entire Jewish community in danger, it is obvious that we are required to hand him over to the authorities. Even if authorities don't know the identity of the criminal, it is befitting to hand him over since he is akin to someone who is pursuing his fellow Jews through his criminal activity. We find a similar ruling in the writings of Rav Yoel Sirkish, Rav David Segal's father-in-law, the famous author of a commentary to the Torah, known as the Beis Kodesh, or Bach for short. The following is taken from a tshuva responsum of his. Someone was accused of stealing from the church and was put to death. On the way to his death, he handed over his purse, which the authorities claimed to have contained an image of their god, Vyeshim, to someone else in the crowd. The authorities claim that the person who received it was the man's father-in-law, who is also the community's sexton, Shamash. The sexton went into hiding, and the authorities are demanding that the sexton appear before them. And now this was the question, and now Rav Yoel Sirkish, the Bach, answers. This is in Simon Mem Gimel 43. After analyzing the sources, the principle that emerges is that if the sexton received the purse in the presence of the Gentiles, then he brought it upon himself and is required to stand before them in court and be adjudicated, says, by their laws, and we are allowed to hand him over. If, on the other hand, the sexton was not the one who received the purse, but was someone else, is forbidden to try to convince the sexton to go before the court, since he didn't bring it upon himself, so that he would be required to stand before them in judgment. And basically the idea is similar to that which Atah says, that this person is putting the entire Jewish community in danger. This last tshuva responsum also gives us a glimpse into the precarious situation Jewry found itself during that period. It is clear from the previous citations that the kihilos, the communities, had their own bote dinim, courts of law, which ruled on virtually every aspect of communal life. These bote dinim, which were guided by the Shulchan Aruch's Talmudic-based system of law, had enormous powers. In the following section, I would like to go through the pertinent sources outlining those powers. Now, in Mishnaic and Talmudic times, there continued to exist, at least in Eretz Yisrael, Dayanim, judges, who had received the original form of smicha, ordination or judicial appointment, which enabled them to be a member of the Sanhedrin, the official court of law, as mandated by the Torah. One had to receive this form of smicha, of judicial appointment, from someone who had in turn received smicha, an unbroken chain which led back to Moshe Rabbeinu. It was Moshe, actually, who appointed the very first Sanhedrin, and they in turn appointed others. Towards the end of the Talmudic period, as the Roman government, which was by then Christian and brutally anti-Semitic, made organized life in Eretz Yisrael increasingly more difficult, this form of smicha ceased to exist. Our present form of quote-unquote smicha, which only dates from the end of the period of the Mishnah, is more properly referred to as Hatoras Harah, permission to issue a halachic ruling. It is generally issued by the Rebbe, the learned mentor of that person, and bears witness to the ability and scholarship of the rabbi to whom it was issued. The original institution of smicha, ordination, or appointment, however, as we stated before, is no longer in existence. In antiquity, a bezdin, whose members had then possessed such a smicha, as the original form, could rule on every aspect of Talmudic, civil, and criminal law. Otherwise, a bezdin is limited to rule over the following. And here in the bottom, page 2, presently rabbinic judges adjudicate cases involving loans, ksuvos, as alimony, inheritance, gifts, and property damage, for they are commonplace and they involve a possible loss of property or financial obligation, and in the sense that the original Sanhedrin would be the kind of deputized, in other words, appointed non-official members of the court to act on their behalf in situations that would commonly come up. And that really gave the power for a bezdin even to this day to adjudicate those issues. As is evident from the Torah, being a member of a bezdin as well as appointing a member to a bezdin is a tremendous responsibility. We quote now from Shulchan Aruch Choshen Mishpat. This is Simon Ches, chapter 8, paragraph 1, Sif Aleph, regarding that responsibility. And here on top of page 3, anyone who appoints a rabbinic judge who is unfit and not a Torah scholar and therefore not worthy of being a rabbinic judge, even though he may be full of other desirous qualities, is in violation of a negative prohibition. And the gloss, this is Rav Moshe Isserlish comments, is forbidden to appoint an ignoramus as a rabbinic judge on the assumption that he will always first consult with a Torah scholar before he renders his decisions. Villages that don't have scholars that are fit to be rabbinic judges, or that matter are solely constituted of those who are unlettered and need to resolve their issues before a rabbinic court instead of going to the Gentile courts, should appoint the most worthy of their community as judges, even though they are not fit to be rabbinic judges. Since the whole community has accepted these people as judges, no one can invalidate them. Similarly, an entire community can accept upon themselves those that are unfit by Torah law to be members of a rabbinic court of law. In other words, there is an idea that even though the person himself may not be learned, but if both parties accept upon themselves, or the whole community accepts upon themselves, they're to follow the rulings of a judge or of a court of law, says they are bound by that commitment. A regular bezdin, guided by Talmudic law, could rule over parties and enforce judgment even against their will. Those who are not fit to be members of a regular bezdin are allowed to rule over the parties in a dispute if the parties willfully accept those unfit individuals to be their judges to adjudicate their legal issues. This is true even though those judges may be relatives of one or both of the parties. This is the governing principle of what we just read at the end of paragraph B, as we now read in the following Chuv responsum from the Bach. And he says, all of these guidelines for the appointment of a judge are only applicable when the rabbinic court comes to impose its verdict upon the litigants. However, when the parties willingly accept them to be their judges, or when they are appointed by popular acceptance to be the community's judges, it continues on, no one can invalidate them. It continues on, this ruling is only relevant for the citizens of that community, since they have willfully accepted these people who are otherwise unfit to be their judges. They cannot impose their verdict, however, upon a visitor who is not a member of their community, because he never made such a commitment. Previously, we discussed the prohibition of going to a non-Jewish court to settle a dispute. There are exceptions, however, when this is allowed, as we now read on the top of page 4. This is taken from the Shulchan Aruch HaShemishpat. This is Simon Chavov. This is chapter 26. This is Sif Beis, paragraph 2. In a situation where the Gentile government has the power of enforcement, and the other party in this dispute is a very powerful person who will not submit himself to the authority of the Beis Din, the plaintiff must first press his claim in Beis Din. If, after being summoned, the other party does not wish to appear before the Beis Din, then the plaintiff can receive permission from the Beis Din to press his claim in a Gentile court and save his property. The gloss, this is the Hagoah from the Ramah, the comment of the Moshe Isserlish. The Beis Din is then allowed to appear before the Gentile court and testify that the defendant is obligated to pay the plaintiff. All of this is only relevant if the defendant doesn't want to follow the verdict of the Beis Din. Otherwise, it's forbidden for the Beis Din to give permission to the plaintiff to press his claim in a Gentile court. Up until now, we've discussed the power of Beis Din as a forum to resolve legal disputes. Beis Din, though, has additional powers as well, as we now read here in paragraph E. This is taken from the Shulchan Aruch HaShemishpat, Simon Beis, this is the second chapter. Any Beis Din, even though they did not receive smicha in Eretz Yisrael, who sees that the populace is unrestrained regarding certain transgressions, it being an emergency situation, is allowed to mete out ad hoc punishments to the violators, whether it be a death sentence or a fine or any other form of punishment. And even if the evidence they use does not meet normative evidentiary standards, if the perpetrator is very powerful, the Bezdin can make use of Gentiles to punish him. They also have the power to deem his property to be ownerless, hefker, and to destroy it according to all that they deem to be necessary to repair the breach of the generation. All of their actions should only be done for the sake of heaven. Such measures should only be taken by the greatest authorities of the generation, or by the Tuvei Ho'ir, literally the good men of the city, i.e. the governing body of a community that was empowered by the Beis Din. Again, the gloss, this is the Hagah of Rav Moshe Israelish. Such is the common practice. The governing body of a community has the same powers as the great Beis Din Sanhedrin. Now, we're speaking about the governing body, not a Beis Din itself. But this is the council of the community. The governing body of the community has the same power as the great Beis Din. It maintains the right to flog or mete out other punishments and to declare a violator's property to be hefker. All these powers are in accordance with common custom. Even though there are those who disagree with this ruling and maintain that the governing body of a community can only mete out those punishments which have customarily been previously meted out, or those form of punishment which were willfully accepted by the entire community, they maintain, however, that the governing body of the community has no right to make any changes which will bring benefit to one party or loss and a loss to another, or to deem ownerless hefker property without prior acceptance of such a measure by the entire community. In other words, the question is about this governing body who was empowered by a Beis Din, but can they extend their powers beyond what originally was the custom at the time that they were originally given this permission? In every situation we follow the custom of the city, and most certainly if the community explicitly vested unlimited powers to the governing body, this is what seems to me to be correct. We are now introduced to the concept of Tuvei Ho'ir, literally the best of the city, i.e. the lay governing body of the community. The Talmud of Masechta Megillah, the Tractate Megillah, speaks of seven Zion Tuvei Ho'ir, the seven good or best people, actually governors of a city. In the period under discussion in Europe, the communal leadership was often in the hands of between three to six Parnosim, or Roshim, the top governing body. Below them, there were assistants to the governors, who were at this time commonly referred to as Tuvei Ho'ir. In other words, the use of the language had changed. Originally, Tuvei Ho'ir represented the highest level of leadership, but by in the Middle Ages, towards in the period right before the onset of the modern era, The term Tuvei Ho'ir was given really to the second tier of leadership. Below them were the Gaboyim, treasurers who administer the charity fund, and the Hegdish, the housing for the indigent, are usually beggars, and the Mamunim, overseers who oversaw the needs of the community, such as the maintenance of weights and measures, and the kashrus, as they used to go to the stores and check out, make sure that the weights and measures were correct. All these officers served voluntarily without remuneration. Amongst the Parnosim, there was usually a rotating chairmanship or leadership. Every month another Parnas was chosen as the Parnas HaChodesh, the chief officer of that month. In the communities of Germany, Moravia, and Western Hungary, the Parnas HaChodesh was the chairman of the council of the Parnosim, and if he saw the need, had the right to call a meeting of the Parnosim and had additional responsibilities during that month as well. But all decisions were ultimately based upon the authority and approval of all of the members of the council. That was the custom in Germany and Moravia and Western Hungary. In Poland and Lithuania, however, during his appointed month, the Parnas HaChodesh was the sole authority of the community. He was the one who initiated actions, made decisions, and directed the community's activities. During that month, the other Parnasim only served as his assistants. Now, the Parnasim only served for a limited term. They were elected by a group of quote-unquote electors, similar to the American Institution of Electoral College. The electors, or Mevorarim, were chosen either by direct election of the community as a whole, or by drawing names at random amongst all those that were part of the electorate. So it wasn't that the electorate as a whole voted these people in, but really they voted in an electoral college, so to speak, and they were the ones who appointed the Parnasim. The electorate was made up of taxpayers. The very poor, those that didn't own property or pay property taxes in the support of the community, were not eligible to vote. In some communities, the taxpayers were divided into categories, usually three, each level having its own specific rights. The office of Parnas was only open to members of the highest category. A recognized scholar, however, those who acquired the title of Chover or Morenu, usually had some or all of the privileges afforded to a man of wealth, as in the Yiddish expression, Oder a Goyin, Oder a Gvir, either a Torah genius or a man of wealth. In those places where the electorate was divided into categories, the upper classes were also given preference, and that a larger number of their members were included in the pool from which the Mevorarim were chosen. Even though the Parnasim were drawn from a limited circle, there was competition amongst them for these positions, and since there were term limits, if they harbored any desire to be reelected, they had to make sure that the electorate was pleased with their performance, just as in this country. This served as an added incentive for those Parnasim to prove their dedication and faithfulness to the community. In addition, the kehila of the community had permanently hired functionaries, such as the shamish, a sexton, or shamoshim, sextons, depending upon the size of the community, sofrim, scribes, marshals, or messengers of the court, shluchei bezdin, watchmen, prison guards, and street cleaners. Those were salaried rather than honorary positions. The community, depending upon its size, also hired a shtadlan, an intercessor, a dedicated lobbyist and diplomat who cultivated contacts with the non-Jewish world and was often forced to travel far away from his home for extended periods of time. In a previous lecture, we followed the life of Rav Josselman of Roshan, one of the most effective shtadlanim in history. These shtadlanim were usually very talented people who mastered the language and legal terminology of the host countries, its political and legal systems, as well as the art of negotiation and diplomacy. Very often such a talented individual acted on behalf of a conglomerate of communities. Another permanent employee of the community was, of course, the Rav, the rabbi, who devoted himself entirely to the community's needs, as we touched upon in the previous lecture. Now, as we said before, the kehila had the rights to mete out punishments. One of the most effective tools that the community possessed was the right to place a wrongdoer in nidui or cherem, terms that we will soon explain. By use of such measures, the bezdin or community was able to ensure the community's compliance with the Torah or Shulchan Aruch and the various laws instituted by the community itself. As we stated before, it is no coincidence that at the end of this era, when the kehila no longer had the power to punish and to put a wrongdoer into cherem, a ban, that the whole Torah-based society began to unravel. Since the institution of nidui and cherem are not widely discussed, I would like to take this opportunity to go through the main principles underlying the use and power of the ban. And here we have on page 5. This is taken from the Shulchan Aruch Yoredeya. This is Simon, Shin Lamed Daled. The whole Simon, the whole chapter is devoted to Nidui and Cherem. And this is from the first paragraph, Sif Aleph. One who violates a prohibition is to be immediately placed in Nidui, a ban. Gloss, the Hagov of Moshe Yisraelish. Regarding monetary matters, however, we don't place the person in Nidui unless he has been warned by the Beis Din three times, on Monday, Thursday, and the following Monday. The ban of Nidui lasts for at least 30 days. If the person fails to repent, we repeat it again for another 30 days. If he still doesn't repent, we wait another 30 days. Then we place the person in the Cherem, an extreme ban. Even if Yom Tov, a holiday, occurs in the middle of the 30 days, it does not affect the person's term of Nidui. This 30-day rule only applied to Eretz Yisrael. The Nidui of the diaspora is equivalent to their Nazifa reproach, which lasts for 7 days. There is a term called Nazifa, which is a lesser punishment than Nidui. And Eretz Yisrael says it lasted for 7 days. The Nidui of Kutzlort, of diaspora, also lasted just 7 days. Our Nazifa, the lesser punishment reproach, lasts for 1 day. That's the Shulchan Aruch. And the gloss, and again, there's the gloss we have over here is in italics. Again, the gloss, we place a person in Nidui even though there is room to think that the person will thereby forsake Judaism. We're not concerned about this. If so, then imposing the Nidui may be tantamount to removing this person and perhaps his entire family from the corpus of Jewry. A most difficult proposition. Rav Moshe Sofer, in his Shuvas Ksam Sofer, entertains a possibility of limiting this halacha. And this is quoted here, the quote in paragraph B, from the work called Pischei Tshuva. Pischei Tshuva is printed on the same page of the Shulchan Aruch, and it's a collection of different responsa which relates to the Shulchan Aruch. So now the author of the Pischei Tshuva is quoting from the Chassam Sofer. Chassam Sofer, in Tshuva 322, wrote, "There is a lack of clarity regarding a situation where the person may convert and place the Nidui and take his underage children with him. Should we be concerned regarding the welfare of these children who have not sinned?" His opinion was that there is a distinction between a regular sinner and someone who harbors heretical opinions. Such a person will, in all probability, train his children to go in his ways. In such a situation, his children as well will be included in the category of, quoting a verse from Proverbs, "None that go to her come back." Referring to heresy. If so, there is no reason to be concerned about their children. For that reason, it seems to me that regarding members of that cursed sect, the believers in Shabtzai Tzvi, unless they have a change in heart, we are to pursue them together with their sons and daughters, etc. When it comes to someone who is merely a difficult person or a sinner, however, who says that we shouldn't be concerned regarding the effect of the ban upon the future of their children? End quote. He elaborates further on this topic and concludes that the matter still needs further research and careful thought. Now, two types of bans are discussed in the Talmud Shulchan Aruch. Nidui, literally someone placed at a distance, and Cherem, literally someone who is cursed or out of bounds. The Shulchan Aruch Yoredeya 334.2, this is chapter 334, paragraph 2, clearly defines the parameters of these terms. And here is on page 6. In regards to the menuda, someone who was put under a ban, no one with the exception of his wife and children is allowed to be within his 4 cubits. There is an opinion that other members of his household are also allowed within his 4 cubits. One can rely upon this opinion. One is not allowed to eat or drink together with him. One cannot include him in Zimun, the collective grace after meals, and he's not to be included in anything that needs a quorum of 10. In other words, he's not counted in a minyan. He has always put it aside. Gloss, well, this is the Rambam. If he was not expressly put into nidui, ban, even though he is a sinner or he violated a communal decree, one may still include him in a quorum of 10 and pray together with him. Even the situation where the menuda, one who has been expressly placed into nidui and cannot be counted a minyan, is present in the synagogue, one still is allowed to pray there. The reason that the menuda is customarily driven out of the synagogue is in order to prevent him from burdening those who are forced to keep a 4-cubit distance from him. During the period of nidui, he is forbidden to wash his clothes. He is like a mourner. He's like an oval. Take a haircut or wear shoes, just like an oval, a mourner. In addition, a muhram, one is put into cherem, this is the extreme ban, cannot teach Torah, nor can anyone teach him Torah. He cannot be hired as an employee, nor can he hire anyone else. Similarly, one is not allowed to bestow any benefit on him in excess of the bare minimum to keep him alive. He is allowed, however, to study on his own in order not to forget his learning. This was added because normally a mourner, an oval, is not allowed to study Torah. In addition, he can open up a small store that will provide him with a livelihood. One is allowed to speak with someone who is a menuda or muhram, unless this was expressly banned by the Beis Din. So really, the term excommunication is really not an exact term for a cherem or a nidui. But he is isolated from the community. And again, the gloss from the Rambam. In any case, one should not speak with him excessively and should limit it to matters which are absolutely necessary, just as one would speak with an oval, a mourner. The situation where one is not allowed to sit in the person's 4 cubits, if one was sitting there before the menuda came in, one does not have to distance himself from him. It is forbidden to walk inside his house, as it has the equivalent status of his 4 cubits. There is no difference whether one is standing or sitting. For the unrepentant, even death is no escape from the effects of nidui, as we read on the top of page 7. This is taken from paragraph 3 of chapter 334. If the menuda dies, Bezin sends someone to place a stone on his casket. One is not allowed to tear one's clothes in mourning for him, nor does one bare his shoulder, that's an ancient custom of mourning, nor is a eulogy said in his honor. This is referring to a ban that was placed upon him for rebellious behavior, as in a case where he violated a rabbinic prohibition. If the reason he was banned was due to a monetary dispute, in other words, he did not appear before the court, or did not follow the dictates of the court in terms of paying that which the court determined. At death, he is released from their decree, and they don't stone his casket, and he is eulogized properly. This is all if he didn't repent, do tshuva. If he did do tshuva, if he repented, then those halachas are not in effect. And we have in paragraph E, in the case where someone had been placed in nidui because he had violated a rabbinic decree, and had subsequently recanted, but died before the Bezin formally released him from his nidui, he is afforded all the regular honors. Besides the basic guidelines, the courts had the option of altering the punishments based upon the circumstances, as we read here now in paragraph G. Again, this is taken from the Shulchan Aruch. The Beis Din has the power to reduce the sentence of nidui to be less than 30 days or to increase it. And the gloss, the Beis Din has the power to impose a severe sentence and forbid anyone from circumcising him as children, or from burying him if he dies, or to compel the community to expel his children from school or his wife from the synagogue until he accepts the judgment upon him. that referring again to the options open to a Beis Din, the Shulchan Aruch rules, again, we continue on. If at the end of his sentence, this is in paragraph H, he has not yet recanted, Beis Din can decide to release him if they so desire. We preferable, however, if they do not do so, nor does the fear of the Beis Din's power be not diminished in the eyes of the populace. Now, if the Beis Din wish to impose a more severe punishment than Nidu, they have the power to directly to put him into Cherem, not to wait the successive periods, the 30-day periods. And J, in the light of the severity of the prohibition and transgression, Beis Din has the power to place even those that eat and drink with the criminal in Cherem, as well as anyone sitting within the criminal's 4 cubits. Regarding the specific crimes that qualify for the punishment of Nidui, here is a sampling, here in paragraph K in page 8. There are 24 crimes which warrant the Nidui punishment. One who slights the honor of a Chacham, Torah scholar, even after his death. 2, one who slights the honor of an agent of the court. In other words, he's an agent of the court, delivering a summons, and the person humiliates him. 3, one who refers to his friend as being an Eved, a slave. 4, one who makes light of even one rabbinic law, and most certainly a Torah law. 5, someone to whom the Beis Din sent a summons and set a date of appearance but failed to appear. 6, one who did not accept the judgment of a Beis Din. He imposed the nidui until he pays the plaintiff. This is just, I gave you 6 examples of the 24. The first category only refers to slighting the honor of a chacham, a recognized Torah scholar. Slighting such a person is equivalent to slighting the Torah itself. However, as we now read from Sif Yud Ches, paragraph 18, a rabbi of a community acquired that position through governmental intervention and is not worthy of the position because of his Torah scholarship, cannot put someone else in Nidui because he slighted his honor. From the following citation, taken from Sif Mem Ches, paragraph 48, we get a glimpse into the political pressure that may be put on Beis Din by someone well connected to the government. If Beis Din has put someone in Nidui for having violated a law, and then subsequently the local member of the nobility, a baron or a count, comes to his defense and decreed a punishment for anyone who would uphold the Nidui, one is required to risk punishment in order to uphold our religion. If, however, they had placed him in Nidui because of matters dealing with interpersonal relations, such as taking his dispute to a Gentile court, they are not required to endanger themselves. In his Agor, the Ramah adds the following, in the gloss. Even though one is required to protect against those who violate the law, and if one was in a position to protest and didn't, he is held responsible, nonetheless, one is not required to suffer a loss of money due to this. For that reason, people are customarily lenient in these matters, for there is a distinct possibility that such people, there's those who refuse and are well connected to the government, will cause us bodily and or financial harm if we protest. Evidently, these political machinations were not uncommon. It is important to realize that the power of the Nidui Echerim was not restricted to the social pressures that were put upon the Menuda or Mukhrim. Every Nidui carries with it a curse, as we now read. Take it from the Gemara in Moed Katan, Daf Yud Zayin, 17a and B. This is in page 9, paragraph N. What is the etymology of the word shamata, which is the shamata, which is the Aramaic word
the common word for nidui. Rav said shamta is shom misa. Death is there because of the curse. Shmuel says it means shemoma yia. He shall be desolate. Its effects adhere to one like grease to the oven. Those you just can't get it out. Because a curse has, in a sense, a permanent, even when he is released, there's some residual effect of the curse. And the Gemara continues on, and this is in disagreement with what Reish Lakish said. For Reish Lakish said that just as when it, the cherem, enters, it penetrates the 248 limbs on one's body, so too on its withdrawal, it departs from the 248 limbs. When it enters, it penetrates all 248 limbs, as is written in quote Yeshua, and the city shall be a cherem off limits and a source of curse to anyone who takes it or has pleasure from it. This is referring to the city of Jericho after its defeat. The gematria numerical value of cherem is 248. So too, at its withdrawal, it leaves all 248 limbs that is written in wrath, remember, rachem. To have compassion, the numerical number of rachem is also 248. Rav Yosef said, and we'll continue on the Gemara, cast a shamta on a dog's tail and it will do its work. For there was a dog that used to eat the rabbi's shoes and didn't know which dog it was that did it. So they pronounced a shamta on the culprit and the dog's tail caught fire and got burnt. Evidently afterwards they didn't have a problem with the shoes. There was another example. There was a domineering fellow who bullied a certain Talmudic scholar. The latter came before Rav Yosef for advice. He said, go and put shamta on him. He replied, I'm afraid of him. Rav Yosef then said to him, then go and take out a written declaration of shamta against him. In other words, to write it up. I'm the more afraid to do that. In other words, like to publicly, you know, publish this. Said Rav Yosef to him, take that written declaration and put it into a jar. Take it to a graveyard and hoot into it 1,000 sheep or horn blasts, a shofar, on 40 days. He went and did so, the jar burst, and the domineering bully died. It's a curse, it's a klola. This, as we say, a bruch has an effect, a klola, a curse has an effect. What is the significance of using a shipur? In other words, the word shofar, it's really a hint in the word that he'll pay the penalty. Chinifroyim, he will pay. So the shipur and the word shofar have a similar sound. What is the significance of tabra? Is that the expression for the tooting, the sound of breaking or crying, which is made by the shofar? Said Rabbi Yitzchak, son of Rabbi Yehuda, suggests the breaking down of high houses for the arrogant. For as Tarav Shimon Gamliel said, that wherever the sages set their eye against someone, the result is either death or poverty. We spoke about the social impact of being a menuda or a mukhram, and how the Beis Din, through increasing the severity of the punishment, can increase its impact. Regarding the aspect of a nidui being a curse, it would seem that here too, the Beis Din has the option to increase the impact of the curse, as we now read here on bottom page 9, paragraph O. This person, this is quoting from a responsum of the Rambam. This person did not respond to the voice of reproof, nor did he heed the words of correction. Rather, he pursued the dictates of his evil inclination and followed the obstinacy of his heart. Consequently, we took out the sacred Sefer Torah against which he had been had a brazen defiance to rebel, and placed him in cherem in public in the presence of the community, anathemizing him through the divine name. In other words, not just that they put the cherem in curse, they took out a Sefer Torah. And that's from the Rambam. From the Meiri, this is Neri was died in the beginning of the 1300s, 1306, in Provence. He was a leading scholar. He writes, commenting on the Gemara in Moed Katan and Tezayin Amud Aleph on 16a, this is referring to the normative case of Nidui Cherem. They have the power ever to impose a longer sentence or additional prohibitions, whether to him or to those who associate with him, which we've discussed before in the Shulchan Aruch, or to declare the Nidui through the use of shofros, ram's horns, or a funeral bed. They would take out a bed that would take out normally a dead body and put it, symbolizing this will be, the effect of the curse. So they really have the right, they have the power to increase the level of the curse. I would like to conclude this lecture with the following. Every community had the power not only to try cases and impose various forms of punishment, including nidu and cherem, but they also had the power of legislation as well. Every community had its takonas, bylaws, which governed the internal dynamics of the community. It seems from the sources that the power behind their legislation was the implied cherem punishment for those who violated the takona. So when they made the takona the legislation, it was put in that he who violates it is subject to cherem. The following excerpt from a tshuva response written by Shimon ben Tzemach Duran, the Tashbatz, who died in the year 1444, gives a deeper understanding into the inner workings of the community in Stakonis. Here, we quote here on page 10. The question is regarding a Takona law which is agreed upon originally by all or most of the community, and now the community wishes to repeal it. That was the question. There are, however, a few people who object to repealing the old law. Do they have the power to prevent the repeal and to annul the cherem that was placed upon the community through the original agreement? That was the question. In other words, does the repeal have to be unanimous? So he responds, I would first like to unequivocally state that the majority of a community in the presence of the Tuveu Ir, the governing body of the community, has the power to force the other members of the community and to impose a cherem or shamta upon anyone who violates their decrees and breaches the fences which they impose. No individual has the right to say that he is not to be included in the results of the final decision. Anytime a cherem is imposed, an individual voice is subordinate to the majority and is responsible to uphold the voice of the majority. So if they have a vote, and the person is outvoted, it becomes just like in the United States, it becomes law through the majority. Then it carries with it, though, the implied punishment of cherem.
If they don't
abide by it. As to the power of these takonas and the cherem, we end off this lecture with the following here in paragraph B. One who makes an oath not to be subject to the takonas of the community has made an oath in vain, and perforce the takonas of the community are binding upon him. If he does not act in concert with them, he is in violation of the implied cherem of their takona. In gloss, this is taken from Shulchan Aruch Yoredeya Siman Reish Chof Ches, which it deals with oaths. And the Sif Lamed Gimel, this is in paragraph 33. If he swore not to reveal a certain matter, and afterwards they imposed a cherem to force him to tell them, in other words, he was asked by the community to tell something which was important for the community to know, and he says because of confidentiality, this is not an uncommon. He does not want to tell, and they impose a cherem. He is required to tell them, and no one can say I didn't hear about the cherem. You know, if a cherem is imposed and he violates it, well, I didn't know there was a cherem. For even though he didn't hear about the cherem, nonetheless, the cherem of the community takes effect upon every person, if there was actually a vote, whatever. A community that declares a cherem on the whole city, that cherem takes effect upon all the members of that city, even upon those who didn't pay taxes, because even though they're not part of the electorate. It is forbidden to violate the stringencies of a city as long as the person is within the tchum, the 2,000 cubit boundary surrounding
the city of that city. In this lecture, we have concentrated upon only one aspect of communal life, the judiciary, the Beis Din, and legislative and executive branches, the Parnosim Tuveir, their assistants, and the Shtadlonim, those who protected the Jewish community through their lobbying and interceding. Much of this influence, of course, depended upon the wealth of the community and its ability to make it worthwhile for the host governments to treat the Jews kindly. In the next lecture, titled The Court Jews, we will explore the role of wealth internally and externally, how the end of the pre-modern era witnessed the growth of a class of Jews who were not only wealthy, but also increasingly more acculturated and open to the culture of non-Jewish, of the non-Jewish world. Now, are there any questions? Oh, okay.
The whole issue of, okay, did him, adjudicating things, what if there was more than one Besdin, some Besdin to the other?
Okay, you're asking what about a situation of a difference of opinion between Batei Dinim and different Batei Dinim, different courts of law, and how in the situations that were dealt with over here, basically a person lives in a community, travel was restricted, a person could travel but was restricted, and generally there was one Beis Din or central Beis Din in a community. Even though a larger community, so they had to have, you couldn't, but there was a, it was under the auspices, the smaller Batei Dinim were under the auspices of the major. There was generally a central rabbinate. You know, in a certain sense, like in Eretz Yisrael today, there may be a central rabbinate and minor courts under the central rabbinate. But there was an understanding that the ruling of one Beis Din is binding upon those who went to those, that Beis Din. If, however, I happen to live in community A, and there's a Beis Din in community B, and it's not part of the community that I live in, they're limited in imposing something upon me. All they can do is issue a summons, which is done. They can issue a summons that the person should take care of the situation. Let's say the two people live in one lives in community A, another person lives in community B. The one in community A has a legal issue with the person in community B. The Beis Din of community A can issue a summons. The person in community B has the right to say, listen, I want it in my community. Or let's create an ad hoc Beis Din. Mm-hmm. This is called, the term is Zabla. Zebur loy echad, zebur loy echad. Each one of the litigants chooses one judge, one dayan, and the two dayanim together mutually choose a third, which is pleasing to both of them. And they, since they wish, that they've desired so, then they accept the authority of that, of now this newly created Beis Din. But one cannot ignore a summons, even if it's from right. You can't ignore it. You would have to respond to it.
Even if it's from another city.
Generally,
that's how does that work nowadays? Because I know in Brooklyn, for instance, there's different Batei Dinim, and I know people have been in issues where they don't respect that particular Beis Din.
I can just tell you what the normative law is, that if one has a summons, one has to respond and say, listen, I'm going to take this to another Beis Din. I'll accept you as authority, I'll accept another Beis Din as an authority, or something is worked out. That's the way really it should be. Sometimes conditions are less than ideal, but that's really what should be. That is the norm.
The difference between Nidoy and Cherem,
So we said that Cherem is an extreme form of Nidoy. In other words, not only is the I'll just quote this again here. Okay. Yeah.
As far as teaching.
Yeah. So it
Yeah, they're both, they're one cannot teach Torah, and we cannot, in terms of, you cannot teach Torah and you cannot be an employer or employee. So you really are very extremely limited in terms of your livelihood. And one is only allowed to have a small store that will just give him enough.
But nobody can go into the store.
No, so for that, well, they'll keep their distance. You know, a person is in the distance.
That's chayrim.
Yeah, even a chayrim is a more extreme form of the nidui.
Uh-huh.
There's not only, not only Jews can't be in their foramas, you can't deal with him, you know, in terms of an employee-employee relationship. You can't do business with him at all. So it's, again, it's another form of isolation. The extreme form of isolation. And plus you have the you know, the curse. Yeah.
I was under the heading of the power of the community. You mentioned that the community might decide to rescind a previous law. It makes me think, now, if it was a generation later and there was a different base thing then, would they have that power? Like, or would it depend on if they were, you know, the Sanhedrin, right? If it's greater in authority or number,
right?
It can, but otherwise it can.
Right, right. So when we're dealing with a law from the Sanhedrin, which is based on, it's a uniform law in the entire Jewish community. There's a rule that once it's put into place, it can't be rescinded only by a bezd in a court of greater authority, of greater competence. But over here, these are takonas of a city. These are and the takonas, generally, it's understood that takonas, I believe, the takonas of a city, as the legis, the bylaws of a city, are always dependent upon circumstance. So if they went, the other Beis Din sees, the next generation sees, well, circumstances have changed, there is either there's no need or it's really counterproductive, they have the right to make those changes.
Those chayrims that were made against the Hasidim in the 1700s, so those were made by specific communities?
Right, so the communities really, it's really about in terms of, again, a cherem really, one really has to be a member of the community to that it should have authority. Really, one can't have
against
somebody up from another city. I mean, there is a question of how far the cherem can go. In other words,
like if the Vilna Gaon
breaks the cherem. Right, on the Hasidim, the question is, but the Vilna Gaon is in Lithuania, there's the Rabbonim in Lithuania, people live in the Ukraine. So it's not so simple. It's not so simple that the authority goes beyond the area where it was understood.
Beyond Vilna, or
the Lithuania, there were more than one, it wasn't just the Vilna Gaon, there's Rabbonim that placed the person in cherem. But a cherem, though, is a curse. So even though one may not formally be put in cherem, it's not a good policy to be cursed.
Under the heading powers of the judiciary, you started by saying that the judges have powers in money matters, like money disputes, because they were commonplace. A couple pages later,
we're talking about death sentences. What did I miss here? Like, how did they get so far? You're asking the question. Here, we said about their powers in terms of monetary disputes. Then all of a sudden, we're giving out death sentences. The courts were charged in really upholding a Torah law. Or Torah law includes what the person is required just between him and God, in terms of that which is mandated by the Torah and that which is mandated rabbinically, which is also binding by the Torah. There are also issues of disputes between two people. Does he owe him the money? Doesn't he owe him the money? the courts have control really on both. However, when it comes to disputes, the cherem that they place, the forced cooperation, it seems to be of less stricture than the cherem which a person violates the law. There's at times a person understands that there are often the questions of paying someone. This is the situation is always very complex. There's also a lot of emotional involvement here that I feel that I was cheated. I was dealt with. This is incorrectly. And in those circumstances, even though there is a cherem placed, but it's not of the same level of enforcement. But when it comes to someone who violates the law itself, under normal circumstances, they put the person in need to it. Just like a person, similar to the person who does not want to accept authority, bezin, in the personal matters about taking to the courts or accepting a judgment in the courts. But when it comes to a person who openly, violates the Torah, the bezin normally would put the person in cherem, but has the right, if it sees fit, if giving the death penalty if need be. Just as the Sanhedrin would. There is it considered like deputies, ministers of the original Sanhedrin. Their law, their powers are limited, but under circumstances where the Torah itself will begin to unravel, just as the Sanhedrin has the right to take extreme measures, they too have the right to take extreme measures.
Did they ever do it?
Put people to death?
Yes.
Well, there are cases by a Mosser, someone who is a they would normally put someone to death, but a person who's a musser, who is an informer, who was really a threat to the community, if they had the ability, whatever it is, they would put them to death. Well, if they have the ability, you have to know how to do this. Where you can buy cyanide, for instance. You just have to. Normally, the authority probably would not allow it, but sometimes with a well-placed bribe. Okay, good to vote.